Hello there, all you lovely people. Welcome back to For Real. I'm Kim Stewart, and today we have the ridiculous joy of welcoming Sean Dietrich to the pod. Sean, I'm kind of a mega fan. Sean is one of the most creative people I know. He writes long form, short story, fiction, memoir, narrative essay, some of the absolute best stuff on social media, and as of this fall, one of my favorite novels of all time. It's so good. I feel a little like a sloth when I read that list because Sean's productivity is almost embarrassing to the mere mortal. But he's such a nice guy. I'll say no more and just let you listen in because this person does not need any more introduction. Here he is, Sean of the South, Sean Dietrich. Sean Dietrich. I am so excited to have you on the podcast. Thank you for coming on to For Real.
Oh, thank you for having me. You should raise your standards if you're that excited.
Listen, I am so stoked. In fact, I'm a little embarrassed to report that I was so stoked. I sat down 2 hours ago and turned on my computer and was like, gosh, I don't know where Sean is. That's how excited I was. I made a different time in my head. I don't do this on the regular. This is to show you my enthusiasm.
Wow. Well, I am extremely flattered.
Well, I've been late to church every day of my life. And so I guess we need to unpack that with a therapist. But anyway, I was on time for you. And I have to ask before we do a darn thing, for those who are new to your party, I would love for you to tell us a little bit about how you came to be known as Sean of the South. You have a moniker, Sean.
Right.
You're like Cher. You're like Madonna. You are a thing. So how did this happen? You and Sting are the same. So tell me how this happened.
Yeah, well, we're nothing alike.
Cher, Madonna.
I might be more like Cher, you know, okay. Only old Cher, you know, Cher who has to have a walker to get on the stage. So I was at breakfast with a friend, a long time ago, my neighbor's blowing off his yard.
No worries. My neighbor does that.
They only do it when I have a podcast, you know, going on.
So. You can set your watch by it. Yep.
And I was at breakfast with a friend and we were talking and I just started blogging and they said, you know, you need a name. I said, well, I got a name. They said, no, you need a name. That's something that kind of rolls off the tongue. They said, it's got to be something Southern, you know, to depict what, you know, your Southern roots. And I said, well, how about Sean with the Wind? And they said, nah, that's not good. I said, well, how about Sean, but not forgotten? And they said, well, how about, you know, one of your favorite songs from the band Alabama, Song of the South, Sean of the South. And that stuck. The first time that it was ever put in print, it just kind of stuck, and now my wife calls me that name during arguments.
Oh, she does. So now it's a cuss word.
Yeah, exactly.
John of the South.
It's an expletive. So
okay.
Kind of like when your mother would use your full name.
You better believe it. Kimberly Ann. She only took that out in very dire circumstances. It was a flag.
Yes, that's Jamie.
Okay. That's awesome. Well, listen, Sean of the South, not used as an expletive. I would read anything you wrote, and I am dead serious. I don't say this often, okay? And usually I usually say that about dead people.
Well, I'll do my best. But
to be dead or to write. Your writing, try not to think of this too sappily, but it sings. I love it. And I want to know, did you always know you were going to do this? Because it feels like you came out this way because it's so natural. The rhythm and the cadence is so natural. And you're in every genre, fiction, nonfiction, a beautiful long time running blog that you just mentioned. I don't read a lot of blogs. I do read yours. You have the visual pieces on that you make. You are a storyteller from the stage. You're a musician. You are the most life-breathing spot on social media. And let's just take a moment to appreciate that. So did you just were meant to do this? Or did you come around? Was this a roundabout circuitous journey for you?
Yeah, I'm not. I have a lot, you know, I hadn't been taught how to do anything. So I take credit for all the mistakes that I make. I certainly never thought that I'd be a writer, because I've always seen that as an occupation that took a lot of academic pedigree to get there. And so it's kind of I came in through the back door. It's kind of a joke on humanity that I am even writing at all, because I don't know what I'm doing. And I think a lot of people kind of pick up that, does he know what he's, no, he doesn't.
Not.
The trick is you move quick enough so that they don't pay attention long enough. So is he, what you doing now? And then they haven't figured it out.
That is an absolute lie. You do write about that you did not have, you weren't headed through academia with like a clear and present movement. So talk about that, because a lot of folks who are listening, I also do not have a degree in writing, and I came around through a different door as well. So talk about that, because I think people think there's a road and you have to get on the road and you have to do X, Y, Z before you can call yourself a writer. And that is not true.
That you're right. I mean, I've discovered kind of through the roundabout way that I respect artists and people and writers and anybody in any field who has come to it a little later in life, and they've come to it through the back way, like you too, I'm sure. I have to say that first. Mm-hmm. So I never had a clear cut idea what I wanted to do. I dropped out when I was in seventh grade, and that was, you know, in some ways it was the best thing that ever happened to me, and in other ways it was the worst. But what it did for me is it gave me, it's kind of like a guy who goes without water for 3 days. You know, by the time he gets that first taste of water, that water is making quite an impression on his palate that it would never make on yours or mine. And probably if he went for 3 days without water for the next chunk of life, he's going to appreciate water in a different way than he's never appreciated it. I think that might be a little of what drives me in many, many areas, but especially writing, because I went so long not doing it, not being able to do it, not feeling like I could do it. And then when I finally gave myself permission to go with it, wow, you know, it was extremely gratifying.
So how many years ago did you give yourself that permission?
I want to say it's been 12 years ago since I started writing in earnest.
Okay.
And once I started, I decided that I liked it and I wanted to get better at it. And I wanted to do a little bit of it every day. I didn't want to slack up on myself. I wanted to do some every day, and whether it was good or bad, just to kind of play with it every day. And since then, I've kept very true to that promise. The most I think I've ever taken off not writing anything in a day is a couple of days.
Wow.
So it's become a kind of a piece of of who I am and how I process the world. I can't really process something unless I write about it.
Okay. I want to return to that in a minute. Your rhythm of writing and how you do that. But before we get too far from your neighbor's comment that you're Shaun of the South, and now that I know that it's a cuss word, I often think of geography. I think when writers do write by a place, the place can become a character. So the zip code itself is like its own spot, and not everybody can pull that off, but you sure do. And I'm wondering, how does being from the South affect what you write, how you write? And part B of that question, what do non-Southerners like me get wrong about the South?
That's a really good comment that you made about the place being a character. I went to college as a grown man, and I was in school taking a literature class, and I was so excited to be there. And we read a bunch of literature, but when we came to Kill a Mockingbird, I was asked to, you know, everybody was asked to write like a 200 word essay, just a little exposition thing. And my comment was, I think the most important character in this book, maybe, you know, I'm going against, I guess, what everybody else thinks, was the town itself. I think that was and my teacher, I remember her going, I don't think that's what this book is about. But in my head, sense of place really, really matters to me in a story. And especially when you're in the South, the sense of place in a small community really tells half the story for you, because this immediately envelops, however you say it up there.
Both of those things, I think. We're writers. We get to make it up.
that whole scene or the whole setting kind of encapsulates the people who live in it and the occupations that go with that, the industry that surrounds the town's form of income, and all that plays into how the cafe feels and how the church feels and how the mercantile feels. So I just, you know, I really like I like to read books like that. I don't know if I can nail it, but I really do like to include that in my work. And so then to answer your second part of your question about what do a lot of people get wrong about the South, they think that we're not intelligent, but that's not true. We are also extreme football fans. So we're also,
is that a point for or against?
That was really a joke that fell flat.
You SEC people, I was in Alabama this summer and I just felt like I need to brush up on little asides about the SEC and what I feel about Roll Tide and what's Auburn in my life. And I'm telling you, I was not prepared for how much I needed to know. I was the dumbest person in the room when it came to that. So, but you're saying that's in addition to needing to know about football, there's a misconception, obviously.
There is a misconception. When I go north to do my show, or in the Midwest, it's fascinating to me, because when I do my show here in the South, I'll do the same material. And I play up, part of the jokes are, you know, we play kind of unintelligent, and we poke fun at our own unintelligence and ignorance. It's funny. It can be quite funny. But the laughs in the audience are more, they're more shared. I know someone like that, or I'm like that, or my mother's like that. When you go up north or Midwest, you tell those same jokes, they're laughing at you. they're laughing because they think, oh my gosh, those people really are like that. And the shared joke in the South is that, well, we are like that, but it's not, there's different levels of totality.
You know? Interesting.
We're not completely like that. We just, that's one misconception. There's a bunch.
I think I would be nervous to laugh because I would want to know, are you in on this? Is it okay to laugh right now? Yeah. So, I love hearing you talk about that because you write so compellingly in your work. The humor in your work, I think, is how you diffuse all of those speed bumps, which is so fun to read. So fun to read. I can't wait any longer in this conversation, John. I have to talk about Kinfolk. This is your newest. I'm holding it and loving it. Listen, it's a novel, for crying out loud. We're going to talk about that in a second, but I cried 4 times. I kept track.
Oh my gosh.
I laughed out loud in public in embarrassing guffaws, involuntary spasms, more times than I can count. It's a marvel. I think of this, I don't know if you're familiar with the author William Kent Kruger. He wrote this beautiful book called Ordinary Grace. And that's the Midwest. You remind me of him in a Southern way. And I love his work, and yours too. So here's the thing. What the heck's going on? You've got nonfiction that I loved, and I was a little bit nervous to read another genre from you because most people can't nail more than one, and you do. First, head count your books for me. What number is this?
I think it's 15, or it could be 16. Jamie would know. I don't
listen to what you just said. Like the 12 years ago, you just decided maybe I'll be an author. You can't even keep track of your, you need an Excel spreadsheet. I want to talk to you about that a little bit more. What is the rhythm of your production of writing? Because we'll talk a little bit later about all the other projects you've got coming down the pike, but you have novels and just straight up kind of commentary, memoir. Again, the blog is baffling to me. You said you write every day on that, mostly. Yeah. But then, like, how does a project like Kinfolk factor into this?
Oh, it's a bit, they're busy days. So I wake up at about, you know, 5:30 or 6. And sometimes I'll go for a walk to jumpstart my brain, just to kind of get some sweat going. Then I go on my porch, and that's where, if this is when I'm home, not traveling. And my porch has, it's a typical Southern porch. There's ferns hanging. It's the greatest piece of my house.
It looks lovely. You've taken photos of it. Yeah.
That's where I spend 90% of my time.
Okay.
Even when it rains, I just love it out there. So I will go out there with this computer, and I will tap away on yesterday's writing for the larger projects, whether it's a nonfiction or a fiction. And I'll work on that from, you know, 6 o'clock until maybe noon. And
wow, that's a long stretch.
Yeah. Well, and the time goes by. The time goes by quick. I never have enough time, it seems like. But I love to get – it takes me about an hour to get into the work.
Yeah.
And then once I'm in that zone, you know, I got to have
– don't want to get out. Yeah.
Yeah. So then I follow that thread if it's happening, if it's working. And then I take a short break and I go for another walk or something to clear the cobwebs. I come inside. I practice music because I've got things for the shows that I got to work on. So – banjo or whatever I'm messing with. And so I make some horrible noise. It sounds like a dying cat in this room. And then I go back out to the porch after a few hours and I play around with a column that I'll be working on. And I'll mess with that all the way up until about 6 o'clock. And that's pretty much when I cut off for the day. I can't really go past there. And if we have a gig like we did last night, we drive to the show and I do that. Then I shake hands and hug necks, come home and I just go, and then I wake up next morning and I do it again. This is why I will die young. But no good artist ever lives very long.
I'm glad you said that with a little artiste emotion.
That's right.
Or you'll live to a million because it's such a sustaining practice for you. We'll see.
The one thing I have discovered about myself is how safe and how productive I can be in routine. If I keep routine, and the routine is the golden standard that I never break, even if I just lightly touch on the routine instead of adhering to it completely, but even if I just, if I pay reverence to that routine, I can do a lot. But once that routine goes out the window, if routine is threatened, I can't do anything. I'm just
a
mess.
How about that?
It's a weird, my brain, I guess.
No, I think most of us are wired like that. It just takes some chutzpah to get out on the porch every single day. So, I can't stop thinking about this, book, your newest, which is Kinfolk. We're recording before its release. I just want to talk in detail about the plot, but I am not a spoiler. I've written a few novels myself, and it's always super uncomfortable for me to talk about the book without giving away the book. I'm a weirdo that doesn't even read the back of a book. I don't want to know. I don't want to know anything. I don't like trailers. Just let me jump in and not get out of the story. I want to talk about Nub and Minnie. Your characters are amazing. Benny and Emily and Leanne. Like those people became real people to me. But I'm not going to spoil. I do want to ask you about Hope. You write about some pretty dark themes in this book. This is why this is a Marvel book for me. I love a book that can have multiple layers going on, that there are hard things and beautiful things. And there's this dance, and you don't pick one lane. And I don't think that life is one lane. But I think it's really tough to do that convincingly in a novel, which is why typically people go one way or the other, and you have steadfastly pulled both of the light and the dark into one book.
Wow.
I'm wondering how in the world you thread that needle so well. And is that an intentional choice to have both?
Yes, it's definitely intentional. I don't know. I mean, I'm so flattered by what you're saying, because when I finish this book, maybe like any author, I'm thinking, this is the worst book I've ever written.
Every time.
It's just awful. I can't believe I'm about to let this out to the world. This will be the end. This is the career ender right here. This is horrible.
I assure you, it is not. It is fantastic. Well, you need to ignore yourself.
When I first set out to write my own story years ago, my editor was on the phone, and I had never written a nonfiction book like that before. And she said, well, what do you want to accomplish? And I said, well, you know, my life has been pretty messy. It's not particularly a good story. It's kind of sad. In fact, when you talk about it in public, it just kind of, people's faces turn to wood. They just kind of, but I want to tell it in a funny, uplifting, happy, cheerful way. And she said, well, I don't think you're going to be able to do that. And I thought to myself,
vote of confidence out of the gate.
Well, she might have said that because she was smart enough to know that if she challenged me, that I would try. And I really did try to, and that was the first time that I had written about a dark subject with humor and hopeful theme underneath. That's what I was trying for, so that it was pleasurable to read in a way, but also so that the reader and myself don't feel that I take myself or my circumstances too seriously. And I think that's a real talent that our ancestors had. They learned how to apply humor and not take themselves as seriously as we've grown accustomed to taking ourselves in modern day. So anyway, when I set out for this book, that was the idea. I wanted it even more so. I wanted it to be hopeful, and yet I wanted not to shy away from some of the hard stuff that real people do go through, which I myself have been through, and you have been through, and everybody that we know has gone through something. And so,
what came first for Kinfolk for this book? Do you think about, was it a main character? Is it, as you're saying, some of the things that have dovetailed with your life?
Well, I don't know how much you want me to give away of the plot.
Not very much. I don't even read the back.
Yeah, I won't even give anything. It was just a thought of a main character and where I wanted this character to end up at the end. That was all I had. And my thought was, let's take this character. Let's put them through the school of hard knocks.
Yeah, you sure did. I actually really appreciate. There were a few chapters that, first of all, you end chapters like a ninja. Okay. But I don't know if you mean to be doing this, but it's almost impossible to put down the book. I didn't cook. People went hungry. I didn't sleep as much as I needed to. I'm really blaming you. But you did. That's a skill set. But also, you did not spare hardship. I mean, you didn't make this seem like all these people are doing fine, except for one person who's struggling. I really actually appreciated that, because again, then when you infuse light and humor, this is real life. We are these people.
I appreciate you saying this. This means a lot. This is the first podcast or anything I've done about this book. This is a great, you're awesome. Well,
I'm telling you the truth. I'm not good at falsehoods. So
I know a lot of the hardship that I went through, but I've also, through doing what I do is the moniker Shaun of the South, and do these shows and stuff, which you know and understand, like any public, I guess, person does. A lot of people come up to me after the show. Last night, just to take last night as a example, it was at a little theater in a small town called Gadsden, Alabama. And after the show, I counted, after I did and I hugged everybody in the receiving line, I counted 26 suicide survivors.
Wow.
Who came to that line.
Wow.
Which is a pretty modest number, actually, in some of the bigger events. That's just the one thing that a lot of people who have identified with me, that's not counting all of the other, the cancer scares and the cancer victims and the so on and so forth. So I've come in touch with all these beautiful people with these powerful, powerful stories. And I listen to how they process them in their little short 5-minute speech when we get together. And it's always with humor. And it's always with, there's always a form of, I'm going to get through this. God has brought me this far, that kind of thing. And I, a long time ago, I decided I wanted to tell those people's stories if I could, if I were so fortunate.
Hi, everybody. Just a quick break here to let you know about a fun resource for all of you visual people. Did you know that you can watch for real on YouTube? It's true. You can see when I'm wheeze laughing off camera, take note of when the lawnmower kicks up outside my window, and see all of these conversations unfold in real time. So if you are more of a watcher than a listener, head on over to the Kimberly Stewart YouTube channel and pop some corn. We will be happy to see you there. And now back to the conversation.
I want to take a slight pivot. It's actually connected to this novel, but can we talk about the Grand Ole Opry?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. The Opry makes a cameo, several cameos in this book, but is also making an actual appearance in your real life. I have only been a tourist at the Grand Ole Opry. I was one of the people who stood in line with my children to go stand on the stage, have a photo taken in front of the microphone, and you're getting ready to go back for the third time performing at the Grand Ole Opry. I would like you to spill all the tea. How in the world does that feel?
I'm pinching myself right now, still.
Honestly.
Because none of it feels real, for one thing. So backstory, you know, Opry was huge in among my people. My daddy used to sit in the woodshed and listen to the Opry on 6:50 a.m. And when I was a kid, we lived in Spring Hill, Tennessee for a short period. And daddy would take me to the Opry. And my mother, when she came to the Opry for the very first time to see me perform, sat in the same section where she sat when I was a 3-year-old boy.
Oh my gosh.
And said in that section, she recalls specifically that I sold my diaper completely and everlastingly. And she turned me upside down and changed me right there in the seat. My daddy said, "Can't you take me to the bathroom?" She said, "I paid a lot of money for these tickets. I'm not missing this show." And I just about sold my diaper on stage too.
Full circle. We love closing the loop. That is amazing.
It was the most powerful. That was the most powerful moment of my life. And it had nothing to do with the music. And it had nothing to do with the performance. It was everything about what you just said, full circle. Because there was a guy in the audience, one of my readers who I've never met before, who had printed out a picture of my late father, his headshot, and had it held up in the audience.
No, we didn't.
So I saw this photograph of my dad looking right at me. There were people holding up signs. They'd come all the way from Maine, from California. These people had never met me before. And I got on the stage and I began to weep when I got out there, because it just, none of it. I was backstage. They said my name. Jamie was with me. She said, "They're saying your name." And I said, "What?" I mean, I couldn't move. And she got her hands behind my shoulders and she pushed me. And I kind of staggered out onto the stage, a zombie, just had no clue. And that's when I doubled over. When I heard everybody's noise, I doubled over and just, I began to cry. And as I cried and the noise got louder, I thought, "You're going to have to suck it up, big boy, because you are also on the Grand Ole Opry and you don't want to just be out here and cry." And so I stood up straight and something took over, you know, the little performer in me. My parents, my mother and daddy have been shoving me up on stages since I was a child since I was about 7 years old. It was the first time I ever sang in front of an audience, and something took over, and I did what I was supposed to do, and it was such a surreal experience. It felt like shotgun blasts of bricks hitting me in the chest, just boom, boom, because all I could think about was not the moment that I was in. I was thinking about my entire history that led me up to this moment, the good and the bad and the ugly. And it was really powerful. And I, even now, I go back and revisit that moment in its entirety. And I remember that feeling exactly. And I hope I never, ever forget it.
Oh my gosh. What I love, one of the things I love about that story is the idea of people surrounding you. I mean, even the Opry itself is kind of it's almost like a circle. I just love the idea of all of these people, many of whom you didn't even know, but you have been pouring words and hope and story and honesty into their lives for years. And they came from Maine.
They had come from every state. We had someone representing every state. And then after it was done, my wife and I threw a party, and I said, anybody who wants to come, come. And we got to the place that we had rented for the price of a small 3-bedroom condo, is what it was, really expensive.
Nashville.
And I got there, people were standing on the sidewalk. I came inside through the crowd, and these were all people from every state. Every state, they came from Canada. Someone came as far away from Norway.
Wow.
And I looked at them and I said at the top of my voice, I said, I will hug every last one of you. I swear to you from the bottom of my heart, I will be the last one to leave this room tonight. If you came here to meet me or shake my hand or do whatever, I hugged next until 5 o'clock in the morning.
No, you didn't.
Yep. And when I was done, I was wearing the same suit that I'd worn on stage. My wife said it was so covered in sweat that you could have stood up on its own. I slept.
The mark of a great party.
I slept for a full day afterward. It was quite a party.
Wow.
My friends, band that I used to, friends of mine, they were playing up on the stage. It was such a surreal. Oh, it was surreal.
Amazing. I love that you are so creative in so many different spaces, and that space pulled together a lot of different people: music people, storytelling people, book people, column people.
It did. My editors for the book Kinfolk were there, and they were standing in that huge party, and they both, all of them came up to me with tears in their eyes and tears in my eyes. And we just cried and hugged, because without giving anything away in the book, you know, it was like, can you believe what just happened here?
Because is stranger than fiction. Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Oh my gosh. You mentioned Jamie, who now I have emailed with. And so I feel like we're really friends, and she's fantastic. As you know, I love the way you talk and you write about Jamie. You guys have a very unique and beautiful, relationship that kind of has weathered a lot of things and is still weathering in beautiful ways. Like, I just think my suspicion is that if only I had the porch next to yours, we might need to boot you off and we would have plenty of things to talk about. But you've been collaborating, not just Jamie, that great collaboration of your whole life, but you've been collaborating with some fantastic women lately. I'm thinking of your sister in You on the Porch. I want to ask you about that. Mm-hmm. And then also a young lady named Becca. Can you tell me about both of those people?
Well, so my sister is a beautiful, beautiful soul. Grew up just as hard as I did. She dropped out of school in kindergarten. No one ever made her go. And she got her first real job when she was 13, working fast food. And since then, it was just tough for her. So she never learned how to read until she was, I think she was 20 or 21. She told me, but I've forgotten. Anyway, We have always sung together. We have always sang, always sung. One of those two.
Yeah, that.
And she, as this stuff has been happening in my life, she's just kind of been right there with me. She took the picture of my first album, so that, you know, she's a pro photographer now. She works as a pro photographer. And so she came up, we posed my dog and she got the picture just right. So she came and did a show with me a few nights ago, or a few weeks ago, or last month, I guess, and brought the house down. You know, she's never sung on stage with me like that before. This is the first time we've ever done that. And it was so powerful for me. And so life is with her, life has kind of come a full circle. She's a mother of two. Great, great person.
She has a beautiful voice. You posted a little bit of you two singing together and I watched it 14 times. I love sibling singing because I think there's something that happens there, but she has just a wonderful, wonderful singing voice.
She's spectacular. And then Becca is she's 11. And so I get a lot of letters from kids with what I write with my blog / column, because it goes into little places like newspapers, small towns and stuff. So this letter came to me from a young woman who had been told by her teacher to write a narrative. And the narrative was about her life. She's 11, so she's not much to write, I wouldn't think. And yet it was pretty long. And she wanted to meet me. That's basically what it boiled down to. She'd had 30 surgeries, I want to say. She had had open heart surgery. She had had her lymph nodes removed. She had ear reconstruction surgery, ear infections. So she's moderately deaf. And then the syndrome that she has called Turner syndrome took her eyesight. So she's completely blind. And the blindness just happened 2 years ago. And so she is learning how to be blind still and grieving for her vision. And this letter to me was so cheerful and so hopeful. So I wrote back to her teacher and said, I need to meet this kid. I really want to meet this child. And her teacher said, okay, sure, we'll meet. And we went to a restaurant called Bama Bucks. And Bama Bucks is located way out in the sticks. And they serve venison on the menu. And across the street, they have this big cage full of deer. So you can pick your deer out like a lobster at a seafood restaurant.
No, you do not. And they butcher it on site.
Well, I don't know if they do it in front of you, but that might be an option for it.
Extra charge.
So welcome to Alabama. And I get there and I see there are these rocking chairs up front, like at a Cracker Barrel. And there's this little girl on this rocking chair, and she's got a white cane in her hand, and she's rocking back and forth, and she's clapping her hands going, I hear him. Is that him? I can hear him. Is that him? And I said, well, hey, Becca. And she gets up and she throws her arms around me. She gives me this hug. We go inside and we eat dinner or, you know, lunch together. And I knew I was going to like her when she ordered the fried chicken, and I ordered the fried chicken too. And we had the most delightful conversation, me and this child. She's really an old soul. She's kind of like a 65-year-old woman in an 11-year-old's body. And it was so moving and impactful to me, this kid's outlook on life. The kid's outlook on life is something that cannot be taught. I don't know. All I can say is that it is actually a gift from on high. But her outlook on life is extraordinarily positive, and it's humbling to be around her after all she's gone through, to see how she processes her daily events. It's quite amazing. She was born into drug addiction. She was born addicted to coke and meth, and all of her problems have stemmed out of that. And here she is going through these horrible things with this sunny disposition. So she's got this magnetism to her. We became really good friends right away. She said she wanted to learn how to play the piano. I've been playing the piano since I was a kid, because I was much younger than her. And I said, well, I'd be happy to show you. So we started working on the piano together. And she'd come over here into my office right here, and we'd mess around on my piano. And she really takes to it because it's so tactile. And then she wanted to learn how to sing. She's always been singing since she was a child, but she wanted to learn how to sing, you know, in a more performing type of way. So we've been working on that, and she's got a
beautiful voice. So immediately I've brought her right up with me on stage, and she's been performing alongside me now. And we have become, I would call her maybe one of my closest friends. Mm. We've become very, very close. She texts me every morning before she goes to school, says, "Good morning, Uncle Sean. How are you doing? What's going on? How you been?" And I text her back. And then when she gets out of school, we text back and forth, and we hang out all the time. I just went up and hung out with her night before last, and hung out with her and her family. And Jamie and I have her come down here all the time, and she's about to come with us on a little road trip where we're doing several shows, and she's going to come with us, and she's going to stay. She loves hotels. She loves hotel pools. So she's going to come with us, and she's going to get to swim in all the pools, and she's going to get to perform on stage. And my wife and I don't have kids. And this is the closest I've ever come to that feeling. And it's been powerful for me. And I think maybe one of the most moving things that happened was before we were going to perform one time, it was really cold in this room. Very, very chilly. And I was freezing, and everybody was eating dinner before we were going to get up to speak and sing and all that. And she's sitting next to me, and her hand was on my shoulder, and she moved her hand down to feel my hand. She said, "Oh, your hands are cold," because she's always touching and feeling. And she got my hand in both of hers and started trying to warm it up. And something about that I broke down crying. Something about that just touched me so deeply, because it was no longer just a friendship thing. That's something family people do for each other. I can remember my mother warming my hands up like that, you know, and she's just quite a soul, quite a dear soul.
I don't know if there's anything more extraordinary or beautiful than when people find each other. It's just the best.
I would agree.
Gotta have your eyes open for it, your heart open to it. So it sounds like you and Becca are both in the same spot for that. I have one final question for you before we sign off, and I let you get back to your fiddling, which is what you've been doing. Every time we've logged on, you have a fiddle in your hand, because of course.
That's right.
I would like, I often ask people at the very end, it's a two-part question about things that they love that they've recommended many times over, and then something that they're excited to dive into new. And so I would like to ask that in terms of music. You do have a new album coming out as well, Porch Music. So I want to mention that, since you have 8 million creative processes on any given day. So my last question for you is in terms of music. So music that you love, maybe an album you love that you have recommended a million times over, you come back to it over the decades, and then maybe something that you're interested in tackling up and coming, or something that's new to you.
An album I love that I would recommend. Is that what that was the question? Okay.
Yes. There's another option. Typically I ask this with books. So if you have books that you would recommend a million times, and a book you're going to read, but because you're a musician and you know, you pick whatever you want.
Okay. Well, I'll do book. I'll say book just because I listen to everything musically. Book wise, there's a book that I love by Maeve Binchy. And my mother turned me on to it, and because I love to read old women authors. Those are my favorite old women.
Okay.
Old women authors. Usually it's better if they're dead. I like them better if they're anyway. Maeve Binchy fits both those requirements. She wrote a book called Circle of Friends. And you know what? Just stay right there. Hold on. And that could be one of my favorite books, and I don't know why. And I'm not going to spoil it for you, because you said that you don't like spoiler. Okay. You might have read it.
I'm anti.
But I just, that book really gripped me. And so I've recommended it to a lot of people. And the thing is when you recommend a book to someone, you know that is the immediate death of that book. They will never read that book.
Not for me.
So I'm very.
It's not the
I'm
death.
I'm very careful how I recommend it. I usually say, well, here's a book, but you know.
Oh, hilarious. You must have very contrarian friends who don't obey you. I will read that book. I feel like I have. I don't know. I want
to. You might have.
Was Maeve Binchy a Southerner?
She was an Irish.
Was she a Southern lady?
She's from Ireland.
An Irish woman. Okay, then. Yep. I can't remember if I have, but that's a great recommendation.
They made a movie out of that one. That's the only book of hers I believe they made a movie out of. And the movie was actually pretty good, but it wasn't a whole lot like the book. But book's beautiful.
Okay. Okay, fantastic recommendation. I obey recommendations. I'm your target market. Do you have anything that you're thinking of reading next that's on the nightstand or on the hope stand?
Well, this sounds so cliche, but I'm always reading something by Mark Twain. He is my favorite. He's my all-time everything. Awesome. So right now I'm reading, or just started reading again. I think this will be the sixth time that I've read a book called Innocence Abroad, which was,
okay, sure.
I think that it was his first book, and it is a thick, it's funny, but it is a thick, I mean, that book would never make it onto the market today. It is so overwritten. How about that? But I love it. And every time I go through it, I find something new.
That's not cliche. That's full on. That's just what I wanted you to say.
I like to read books that put me in touch with all the people who came before me. I don't know why. I feel connected a little more.
Well, if Twain were here, I dare say he would really get a kick out of talking to you. In fact, he'd probably hold court on your porch. That's my guess. You do your region proud, I will say. So, Sean Dietrich, I am so honored that you spent time with me today, and I'm so grateful you're writing like your pants are on fire. Keep it up. I just love what you're doing, what you're putting out in the world, and I love the way you live in your real life with your Jamie and with Becca. I think you're doing great things, and it's just so fun to be able to have a little glimpse into it. So, thank you for your time.
Thank you for saying what you said. It means a lot to me. I appreciate that.
Please raise your hand if you'd like to set up camp on the Dietrich front porch. Same, me. That's exactly how I feel. I love that he seems perpetually surprised that people like his work. I'm telling you, this guy is the real deal, with a guitar and a hound dog and a fiddle. And multiple invites to the Grand Ole Opry, for the love of Pete. I hope you get a chance to pick up Sean's newest book, Kinfolk, which is now in my top 10 of all time. And I'm excited to hear his new album, too, and watch his new dance special on Netflix. Just kidding. I just assume he has other talents we didn't talk about. Okay, that's all for today. I owe you big time if you would be so kind to share this episode with people you love. That kind of thing, along with a bunch of stars and reviews, is what helps us find people who will pick up what we're laying down around here. We'll be laying it down again soon, so don't be a stranger. We will be back, ready to learn and laugh right along with you, for real.